Okay, this is week 5 of our leadership training course on the law of God and public worship. So we'll be looking, first of all, at the law of God, and this, of course, a very important topic because in the modern church, because I think partly because of dispensationalism and also partly because of the democratic ideal in our culture, the law has been really undermined. The idea of law, the idea that there is absolute truth, and so particularly biblical law has been outlawed in the public schools. They can hand out condoms, but they can't post 10 commandments on the walls of the school for fear of the lack of tolerance. And it's amazing what we have come to tolerate in the name of freedom. But in any case, the law, when it comes to biblical revelation, the great tragedy is that there are Christians who think that the law is gone. It's done away with. It's past history, and it has nothing to do with us in the modern situation. And this is, we find from both Old and New Testaments, is utterly untrue. Now, we do have to be careful, because when we talk about Adam's relationship with God as a covenant of work, I don't object to that term. I think there may be other, perhaps happier ways of designating that covenant, a covenant of nature, a covenant of creation. I'm not going to get hung up on that too much. But we need to recognize that even in that covenant, there is a gracious condescension of God. And that's of the essence of God's relationship with us, that he has deigned as the infinite personal God to come down into history and to relate to his creature made in his image, because he simply delights to commune with the creatures that he has made. And so it's the works part of it. It shouldn't be looked at in some narrow way. I think the only reason that the works as opposed to grace and the names of the two essential covenants in the Bible or in the confession, the reason for that is because the writers want us to understand that Adam was able to obey God. He had a communion with God, and the terms of that communion, the conditions, were his perfect obedience. And that is clear in the Scripture. So however you want to label things, that's, I think, what the confession writers and theologians of this era were getting at. But what we want to focus on, though, is the idea of what the law actually is. When we hear law, you know, some of us may picture a 6'5" state trooper looking down at you as you wind down the window, sort of half trembling and half angry. You know, that may be what we think of when we hear the word law. But in the Bible, it has a much richer meaning, and it is much more benign than we normally think of it. It's, in fact, apart from the fact that it shows up our sin, which, of course, does make us tremble. It's maybe similar to when we get pulled over for breaking the speed limit. But the fact is that it is the way of life in thought, word, and deed which pleases God. So we should never think of it as just a bare set of rules. We pervert law sometimes to being just that. And people use it, too, as a paper tiger. Don't be legalistic. Well, you know, that we've got to be careful of that, because the law in the Bible has has positive characteristics that we need to appreciate. Yes, the law is the way of life in thought, word, and deed which pleases the Lord, or which is pleasing to the Lord. So it's the whole way of life. And I say thought, word, and deed because we need to be reminded of what Jesus does in the Sermon on the Mount when he takes commandments such as the seventh commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery. Well, some proud Pharisee might be just, you know, crowing and saying, well, I've never slept with another woman. And Jesus says, but you know, where that begins is in your heart. So have you ever mentally slept with another woman? Have you ever lusted after a woman in your heart? And of course, no man can say that he hasn't. That's the depth of that commandment. Now, the positive side of it is the love of God and the love of our neighbor. And so that love is the root attitude that is undergirding what true obedience to the law is. And it, another way of looking at the law is it simply describes for us as what the confession calls a rule of life. It tells us what pleases God. And so, you know, mom doesn't want you eating before dinner. This is what pleases her. And what's interesting about that simple illustration is the reason she doesn't want you to eat cookies before dinner or whatever is because she wants you to eat the dinner, which is the nourishing meal that she's prepared so that you will be healthy. And that's what the law is like. God has made us in a certain way, and in relationship to him, the law guides us in terms of what is pleasing to him and therefore healthy for us spiritually and even physically. Now, we know that it's actually written in the heart of the unbeliever, that, you know, the conscience of the unbeliever accuses and excuses. There is a moral detector in every person that tells them what right and wrong is. Now, the fact that they evade it, they pervert it, they twist it, they try to escape it, and they sin doesn't detract from the fact that they still nonetheless cannot escape being those who are made in God's image. Furthermore, we should recognize that long before the Exodus, we see evidence of law in the life of God's people. And one of the great classic passages for this is Genesis 26:5, where it's almost incidental. It'd be easy for us to miss. And in 26:5, we see, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. Oh, where did those come from? See, Abraham, they came from Adam. So this was not complex in the way that the Mosaic system of law was, because that involved both the picturing of the person and work of Christ, and it also involved the national entity of Israel. So it was very complex compared to what Abraham had, but he knew what pleased God. That's what those words indicate, and that had been passed on from Adam. That's the implication there. And notice also that the Sabbath, this has always been very curious to me, that before Exodus 20, when the Ten Commandments was first recorded, they kept the Sabbath. How did they know about the Sabbath? Well, because it's a creation ordinance, and we'll see that, Genesis 2:3. So the law, the idea of the law as the way of life that pleases God, is always there. And in that sense, in fact, it always will be, because in heaven we will live to please God. The only difference is we will have no possibility of sinning, unlike either Adam before the fall or after. Now, as I said, the legalism and antinomianism, as we've said in the past, as are a lot of errors that seem to be opposites, are twins. And in dispensationalism, we see this very odd thing. On the one hand, they want to make the disjunction between the Old and New Covenant so strict that they're actually two different sets of people that they apply to, two different churches, as it were, one the nation of Israel, the other the church of the New Testament. And they also then go on to make a huge dichotomy between law and grace, and they say, we're not under law. And of course, they can point to Romans 6:14. Paul says that. We're not under law, but under grace. And the answer, of course, that we would bring back is that while we do not want to minimize the disjunction or the discontinuity between Old and New Covenants, because there is a tremendous change, there is a sea change in the covenants, in their administration. But we want to be very careful not to mistake the word law, excuse me, here, for moral obligation. And I think that's one helpful way of referring to to one of the ways in which the Bible uses law. There are several ways. But moral obligation is not what Paul is saying in Romans 6. He's not saying we are not under moral obligation, but we are under grace. Sometimes in a tough passage, it's helpful to expand a word a little bit, amplify it, and then read it again. It helps. Who would ever want to say we're not under moral obligation? If you love me, you will keep my commandments. That's what Jesus says. So what does it mean then? Well, it's simple. What it means is the Mosaic covenant. And now we know that in a sense they were not under, the way of salvation was by grace, even under Moses. But we also know that the scaffolding was still extensive and it was burdensome. So that revelation was imperfect, as the writer of Hebrews says. Now, not that it wasn't what God wanted, but it was not what God ultimately had in mind. Now, no painter likes to look at scaffolding. Oh, there may be one somewhere that does, but because it represents his pay, I guess. But the goal is to get it down after. So it's imperfect in that sense. It's perfect while it's scaffolding. It does the job, but it's temporary. It's not the ultimate goal. So we want to understand then law and that at that point being the Mosaic covenant. That's what we're not under. We're under the covenant. We're under grace in the new covenant. And the contrast is between Moses and Jesus, not between moral obligation and forgiveness. I'm going to be very careful there. Well, let me just quickly note, and then I'll take a question, that the other two ways in which law are used, Mosaic covenant, and then what we've just said, moral obligation, and we'll see that in both Old and New. And then a third way, however, oh, how love I thy law. It is my meditation, day and night. Psalm 119. There, the law refers to the whole Bible, the whole revelation of who God is. And so those three basic uses of law. Now, a fourth one would be that sometimes, like in Romans 7, Paul uses law to mean a principle. There's a law in my members. That's pretty obvious, but in terms of the other uses, be careful to always ask yourself, how is the writer of Scripture using law in this passage? Very important question to ask. Now, back to dispensationalism, they want to say we have no obligation to the law. If you ask them, do you have any moral obligation? You know, do you steal from your neighbor? Oh, of course not. Paul says, well, what is that? It's the law. It's the moral obligation that is still binding. It's what the confession calls the moral law. But what's amazing is that on the same breath, they will make laws that are not biblical for the church. And that's legalism. So I would say, actually, that wherever the vacuum left by antinomianism will be filled by legalism. That's what usually happens, is that the vacuum left by antinomianism will be filled by legalism. And we need to avoid that at all costs. Romans 8:7 says, because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to what? The law of God. So the heart that has a friendship with God is going to be willing to be subject to God's law. That's New Testament as well as Old. And especially there, interesting, coming from Romans 8, which focuses on the presence of the Spirit in our lives. One other thing to be careful of when you think about law is the idea of natural law. I think we mentioned this last time, but I really want to get this across, because a lot of the reaction that we're seeing in the church today to the lawlessness in our culture is looking kindly on the Roman Catholic or Thomistic idea of natural law. And there is no such thing, according to the Bible, as natural law. That is to say, that there is no law which is somehow built into things that is abstracted from the person of the lawgiver himself. And that's why I think, if you look back at ancient Greece, that, the law, the standard of absolutes, and the person of God were always separated from one another. Plato, the demiurge and the ideas, they were separate. And the demiurge really was finally answerable to the ideals, the ideas which were absolute. We don't ever want to think of law in that way. God is the giver of law. He is the absolute, and his law is a reflection of his character as God. And that's a real important concept to grasp. Jason? Okay, people would say it's a natural law that the law not to kill is natural law, that it's built into the nature of things. And we would want to say, no, it's the commandment of God. It's not just built into nature, because what you end up doing is then you'll end up getting God as if he is somehow has to fit what's in creation, that we bind him to that. And of course, we can extract. It becomes just like what the judiciary is doing with the Constitution, finding things in the penumbra. We can get any number of things out of nature, and especially get some very perverse things, because we know nature is under the curse and mankind is fallen. So many, oftentimes what people call natural law would be things that we take for granted as being good. So they'd be things like not killing and, the maternal instinct and all of those types of things. What we want to do, though, is just remember their origin, is that they are not so much in the nature of things as that they are reflections of the law giver. The reason I say that is because we also want to understand, we want to be able, when we hear the law from God's mouth throughout all of the covenants, to understand that the administration of it varies in different contexts. And while his absolute character never changes, his nature, his essence, nonetheless, he is always a God who is himself intimately involved in time, in the history of redemption. He is down in it. He is functioning in his creation as the God who brings his people through their history to the final goal. And so he will speak then in different ways at different times about certain moral and spiritual principles. Yes. If you look at Exodus 16:23 and following, and of course then it's also very much implied in Genesis 2:3 that Adam kept the Sabbath, and that was even before the fall. So it is we have referred to it. I always ask this question in presbytery when men have problems about maybe some of the details about how we might keep the Christian Lord's Day. I always ask them, well, do you believe it's a creation ordinance? If they believe that, then I can put up with certain variations of how we keep the day. But if they don't believe that, then they're going to tend towards a kind of dispensational view of the Sabbath. Yes, that's right. We'll look at that in a few moments in some detail. So the thing that elders, though, as leaders, we have got to teach people both in our own example, by our example, but then we've got to encourage them to have a deep respect for what pleases God. It's a tone. It's the tone of leadership. It's why people are upset about the President of the United States, because it's even if it's not impeachable, there is a tone, a moral tone of leadership, which makes up one of the most important elements of being the President of the United States. And that moral tone is what you and I are responsible for setting in the congregation of God's people. They will see how we how we live our lives, whether the bottom line for us is that we please God or not. And we need to also be ready to jump in a loving way to correct them when they show that they have some real misunderstandings. Someone might have, while having coffee, say, well, we're not under law, we're under grace, right? And then you say, wait a minute, let's talk about this. Let me get my coffee. We need to talk about this. And you explain it very gently so that they won't spill their coffee or throw it at you. But we need to be very much aware of the importance of our own obedience undergirding the teaching to have a healthy view of the law. Now, the Ten Commandments. Yes. Natural law? Yes. I would say it is. I'm hearing it more and more, and it's in... Yeah. That's right. Yeah, the empirical movement. Although, I would say that John Locke and the empiricists would be really the forefathers of the movement that would say that law is really a social construction. Remember that John Locke was the one that believed in the so-called tabula rasa, which is the blank slate, and that every soul starts as a blank slate. As Christians, we really wouldn't want to say that. We want to say that every soul made in God's image starts with that. And though it may be not easy to define all of what that means, it means that we have a conscience, that we have a sense of right and wrong that God has given us, made in His image. So see, in that way, we don't want to sound as if we're against the idea that God's law is written on the heart of man, that we believe that. But it's always His law. It's not sort of written into nature in some way that God is accountable to. I would say that Locke and the empiricists would be the great granddaddies of the idea that law is a social construction, and therefore it varies from generation to generation. So you'll hear about people, now here, even conservatives, talking that way too. That's sort of another school. That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, they're not that far off in that they believe in absolute truth, and that's why we always find ourselves warming to what they are saying. But what we want to be careful of is remember that the great granddaddy of our present mess is deism and Unitarianism, which wants God's absolute law, want absolute truth, good stuff to live by, and be prosperous and healthy, you know, Ben Franklin and all that kind of stuff. Pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. I mean, it's all wrapped in together. But don't talk to me about redemption, about a cross, about the need of salvation, about human sinfulness and God's wonderful grace. We don't want that redemption stuff. We can work this out on our own. See, and that's what a lot of people don't realize, that deistic movement, divorcing the moral standard from the gospel, is the great danger in Western civilization. So, they're not really conservatives, truly, but they sound conservative because they'll say, we agree with you that such and such is wrong, okay? But if you get under the skin and say, why do you believe it's wrong? Unlike the natural law people who say, because it's always been that way, it's absolute truth, they will say it's the consensus of the community. And if it stays this consensus for another 100 years, fine, it's wrong. But if it changes, then that thing that was now wrong may then become right. So be careful, because someone who may, on a particular issue, sound conservative, may be a social constructionist. They may believe in relativism. Okay, the summary. The Ten Commandments is a summary, and we need to be careful. And here's something that I think I've only come to realize more in recent years. And this, to distance ourselves from sort of this timeless idea of the timeless law that's not connected directly with the character of God himself. Only God is timeless. His law is always given in time, and therefore it's always going to have temporal characteristics that change, as well as the core, which is the reflection of his changeless character. So what we want to realize is that, for example, the Ten Commandments is in Deuteronomy 4:13 actually equated with the whole Mosaic covenant. So in other words, there's a certain Mosaic quality to the Ten Commandments, which we want to be careful not to confuse with what we're called to obey today. So, and I think we've mentioned these previously, but the fifth commandment, where the Lord's, it's the first commandment with promise, Paul says in Ephesians 6. It's different. What he quotes in Ephesians 6 is different than Exodus. Why? Because there was a promise of the land which the Lord your God is giving you. That's why we're to obey our parents. He's going to bless us and give us that land and bless us in it if we obey our parents and obey lawful authority. Paul changes it to the earth. Oh. See, be careful about saying that this is a timeless commandment. Obedience to your parents is. That's rooted in the very character of God. But the land and the earth, the context of that obedience is different. And the blessing promised is different. It's expanding from the Old Testament to be universally referred to the whole of God's creation. And the same with the fourth commandment. Now, that's got a sort of a triple movement that you can see in it. And this is, I mean, there may be more to it than that, but just on first blush, why would it be in Exodus 20? This is all now under the Mosaic covenant itself. There's movement in the fourth commandment. Creation is the reason you should keep the Sabbath. And then you get up to Deuteronomy 5. It's because he brought you out of the land of Egypt. Now, they were already out of the land of Egypt in Exodus 20. But what are they doing in Deuteronomy 5 that they weren't doing in Exodus 20? Ah, so they're ready to take possession of the fullness of the promise. And that's redemption. Is the center of the reasoning for the keeping of the Sabbath day. And then, of course, we move into the actual consummation in Jesus Christ. Now we have the Lord's Day, which instead of being at the end of the week, represents the first of the new creation. And you look at the Jubilee Law, and you see the richness of that. In fact, we're getting ahead of ourselves here. But all of that shows a movement in redemptive history. So be sensitive to that. Be sensitive to the way in which the commandments speaks to a particular context. But that's not to say that the commandment itself, the essence of it, changes. As long as we understand that essence coming from the very character of God. Now, the summary, however, is it's a 10 commandments. That's actually a symbol, and I'm not big on doing things with numbers in the Bible, but they are symbolic. And 10 is a symbol of historical perfection. So there's a kind of roundness to these commandments that we ought to appreciate, and they make a beautiful summary of God's law. And I have discovered that there is really no ethical question that comes outside the bounds of these 10 commandments. If you know them, and you should, an elder must know the 10 commandments. If I say to you, what's the 8th commandment, as I sip my coffee, you will say, the 8th commandment says, you shall not steal. And you may not have to quote it exactly, but you better jolly well know it, because you're going to deal with someone who may have embezzled money from work, and you're going to have to counsel them, and you're going to have to know the meaning of the 8th commandment in a lot more detail. That's right. Oh, yes, you're off by one. You have to adjust things slightly. So I appreciate that summary. It makes it memorable. It helps to organize our ethical thinking. And anytime you can help to organize something in a way that makes it memorable, it helps to build our mental frame of reference. It's also logical. There's a very clear movement from the centrality of God to the centrality of the importance of the heart in the 10th commandment. And then everything in between is sort of a reflection of the covenant relationship between God and his people. And that's the whole genius of what the covenant is it is a relationship between God and his people. I will be your God and you will be my people. It's that intimate communion of the marriage relationship between the husband and the bride, the groom and the bride, between the living God and his assembled congregation. And finally, it is, as I said, comprehensive. It covers everything. I think we need to be careful of one thing, and that is that we don't know if the two tables were 1 through 4 on one table, which is what this really says, and 6 through 10 on the other table, duty of God to God and our duty to man. Well, the division is fine because that's clearly there is a difference in those two parts of it. One might argue for 1 through 5 and 6 through 10 as the division, but I think it's rather likely that this was a backup copy or the idea of two witnesses. It was probably the 10 commandments were both on each, and there were two copies because God's saying it, and here are two witnesses to what he has said. That's a surmise, but we shouldn't be dogmatic one way or the other. And remember, as you go through the commandments, they're stated often in negative form simply to accent the essence with a particular. That is very important. I've tried to learn that rhetorically. Jason just asked a question about, give me an example. And I remember a teacher in English back in high school said, you're too general. Now, that's why I love philosophy. You know, it deals in these vast generalities. You talk about the demiurge and the ideas. And then someone asks you a question of, how do you work this tape recorder? You know, that's, get down to the details. And I was weak in that area. Be specific is the question. Well, Scripture has taught me to be specific. And the commandments they're pointed. They have a barb to them. And that gets your attention so that you think about the essence of what that commandment is. So, the sanctity of life, if you look at the larger catechism, you see what this involves. I mean, it involves, there's a lot of detail to what this involves, but God doesn't say you will treat life with great respect. He says, don't kill, don't murder. Well, that's a pointed particular. But the essence of it clearly is the sanctity of all of life. And, you know, by, let's say, abusing our bodies, you know, if we're smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day and sitting in front of the tube and drinking beer and eating potato chips and getting, you know, fat and just ready to die of a coronary arrest at the age of 45, that's breaking the 6th commandment because we're not treating our own lives with the respect that God wants us to. So a deep principle has almost an unending number of particular applications, and the larger catechism tries to cover these with a fair amount of range and detail. Jason. Oh yeah, good. That's a very good point, Jason. Yes, I do. I think that negative would never be there if we weren't sinners. And that second use of the law, which is exposing sin and driving us to Christ, is absolutely is present. The law should make any sinner tremble with dread before the awesome wrath of God because of our sin. So yes, good. That's a good insight. Now, I will, you've seen the summary. We could go on endlessly about the 10 commandments, and I assume that you already have some knowledge of what they cover. I do go over it in great detail, incidentally, in the members class, because there are people who haven't thought through these things. I expect that you have, and so I'll take particular questions on any one of the commandments. And I think that's really all that I want to say, because otherwise we could spend 2 hours on each one, and that's not the purpose ultimately of this course. But questions on any particular aspect of the commandments, of the Ten. I mean, this is a field of constant exploration. Look at the larger catechism. Williamson's book, I hope, explains in his shorter catechism, really expands it nicely. And of course, the shorter catechism itself spends more than half of its questions around the commandments. So this is a way of life for the Christian, not a way of salvation, but a way of, as the Continentals like to say it, thanking God is to live pleasing in his sight. We need to give people a knowledge of these commandments. And one way to do it, maybe I'll give you this much, as I'll give you the titles that I put for the ten commandments. If you want, you can just write 10 numbers with blanks next to them, because they're short titles. And this might be a way of just helping you to remember them. The first one is the object of worship. No other gods before me. And the second one is the manner of worshiping him. The manner of worship. No graven image. The third is the attitude of worship. No empty name. And the fourth would obviously be the day of worship. Remember the Sabbath. The fifth would be the sanctity of God's authority structure. Incidentally, there, just to show you the breadth of the commandment, it's not just kids obeying mom and dad, but it's subjects obeying their king. Because what you'll see is that from fatherhood and motherhood, from the basic structure of the family, that is then projected into every other sphere of life, into the state, into the school, into every other area, into the church. Elders are fathers to the people of God, and kings are called nursing fathers, so it has quite a range. Number six would be the sanctity of life. Thou shalt not kill. And this is then the... No, it means don't kill mosquitoes, Al.
I ran into that with a relative. And he brought up this homosexual. He invited a couple of kids here and died on the radar. I was visiting and I kind of made an awful comment for him about Sodom and Gomorrah. In other words, it was what I said wasn't a lie, but it was talking to 200 people, and I have to apologize for being out of step as a guest at the house. Not so much apologizing for what he said. But he said, you shouldn't kill anybody under any circumstances.
Oh, well, that's true. That's, well, not under any circumstances. That's right.
Even God said you're not supposed to kill people.
Oh, people, yeah. Well, actually, those people that murdered that homosexual should be executed. Because they committed murder. And we need to stand up against that kind of thing, because that kind of brutality towards one particular type of sin, as perverse as it is, and we ought to hate that sin, but adding sin to sin is aggravating sin, and it's an awful thing. But yes, sanctity of life, thou shalt not kill, really refers to the unlawful taking of life. Because one must take life in capital punishment. The Bible commands that. Also in preserving ourselves, a self-defense. And then also sort of corporate self-defense would be the military. So in those three areas, the Bible clearly sanctions the taking of human life. And this would be the unjust taking of human life. The seventh is the sanctity of marriage. Thou shalt not commit adultery. And that, of course, focuses on the sexual dimension of that relationship, and all sexual perversion is forbidden. The eighth would be the sanctity of property. Thou shalt not steal. This is really our stewardship over God's creation. The ninth is the sanctity of truth, not bearing false witness against our neighbor. And the tenth is the sanctity of the heart. So worship and sanctity end up being the two basic categories that we divide 1 through 4 and 6 through 10 into. Okay. Yeah, no doubt about that, because the same Bible that tells us that they're put here for to be a blessing, for food, as well as other things, it tells us to be kind to them. And the person who's cruel to their beast is himself a beast. And so we're to be kind to our animals. And there are several laws in the Mosaic Covenant that show humanity to animals. And Christians should be, we should always promote that. I think hunting is a very legitimate, viable sport, but I think that cruelty in hunting would be bad. In fact, I loved, Bert showed me a bunch of old pictures when I was over yesterday, the day before, and one of them showed, he's 16 years old and he's got this deer hanging over his shoulders, and he was supposed to be in school, by the way, and the paper, apparently the principal did read the newspaper and said something to Bert, but it was quite a hit for him. But he had his bow and arrow. He had taken it down with a bow and arrow. And so he was a bow hunter from a long time ago. And it said in the caption that he believed that it was a more humane way of killing deer. And I thought, wow, that's neat. You know, Bert has had that basic humanity since he was a teenager. His love for the outdoors and for animals and that kind of thing is something that, there's a biblical view of animal kind, which used to be part of the fabric of our culture. And of course it is no more. So we have these extremes. You know, we have people that are cruel to animals. You'll hear about, every once in a while in the newspaper, some guy starved 10 cats to death and gets, hauled into court to pay a fine. And then on the other hand, you have people that are marching, they'd rather shoot you if you wear leather shoes or a fur coat. the animal rights folks, they treat animals better than they treat people. That's right, total tremendous inconsistencies. But it's the confusion of unbelief always causes these polarizations. Whereas the biblical way is a perfect balance. Now, three uses of the laws. We move on to this next concept. Very important to understand three uses of the law. And this is not the same as the three dimensions of the law or three aspects of the law which the confession is talking about. These uses, you'll find, are a part of systematic theology. But you need to know these because you will hear oftentimes in Reform circles the phrase, the third use of the law. And you always hear that as the law of God as a rule of guidance in the Christian life. In other words, the way I define it, what pleases God. It tells us what pleases God. That's the third use. But there are two other uses. What are those? I remember I knew the third use for a long time, and I never knew what the other two were. And the other two are the civil and the convicting use. Those are the two, one and two. The civil use has to do, it's called the usus politicus or civilis, and serving the purposes of common grace. This is the law as it teaches people just the way to behave out there in society. And it's not just the government, the government has got to have certain laws about our behavior. And people who say you can't legislate morality have never really thought very carefully about what they're saying, because all legislation involves certain moral assumptions about what's right and wrong. It's wrong to embezzle. Of course, the greatest sin is to keep money back from the IRS, which tells you something about what makes us tick as a nation. But it makes some moral assumptions that taking something that's not yours is wrong, and that civil use is one use of God's law. And of course, you look back at the history of jurisprudence, go back to Justinian and his code, and that was a combination of Mosaic legislation and the biblical, much of which was, of course, Mosaic, and Roman law. And it was a kind of a wonderful combination of the two. So the Christian view of law is still out there, even in the legal and judicial system, as well as the culture generally. The second is the convicting use, the usus electus or pedagogicus. And this would be, you know, Luther would say this is the most important use. It convicts us of our need as sinners. The evangelistic use. You might call it the usus evangelicus. And then the third use is the one we're talking about here, which is the guiding use, the usus didacticus or normativus. Serves to guide the believer in God's revealed will for life. That's where we get the rule of life language.
Temple word meaning?
Hmm?